Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
Hi, dear listeners, welcome to Radio Sai Answering Both, the program where we take on questions on practical spirituality from you listeners, and I, Prem from Team Radio Sai, answers them for you on this show. I begin this week's show, as always, by placing my most loving pranams at Swami's lotus feet. When I was in school, after every lesson has been taught, the teacher would invariably ask the class, "Do you have any questions or doubts?" And suppose no one in the class raised any questions, the teacher would say this, "No questions?" Then it only means one of two things. Either you have all understood everything or you have not understood anything. Yes, if understanding is perfect, then we don't need to ask questions. And if there is no understanding at all, then there is no basis on which questions may be raised. But if our understanding is not perfect, somewhere midway, as we all of us are, then asking questions is the most effective way to further our understanding. And those questions should be born out of a deep yearning. As it is said in the Gita, it is not enough if the student merely asks prashnas or questions, but the student should put forth pariprashnas, or questions that are born out of genuine seeking. And we will ask such questions when we genuinely want to practice Swami's message in everyday life. Those of you who have followed this program will agree with me that we've had such a variety of questions so far. On parenting, business, family life, choosing careers or life partners, questions relating to health and diets and many such. We've also had some philosophical questions too. And it has been thoroughly exciting for me to bat all these questions. Of course, every answer was purely Swami's and not a bit my own. So I thank you all for the wonderful questions. And of course, the more questions I get, the longer this show will last. So if you have a question bothering you, drop it at Radio Sai Answering Booth. Before we head to the questions for this week, let me read out to you a quote that I found interesting, and I hope you will like it as much as I do. This quote is from one of the brightest minds gifted to the world by India or Bharat. And he is Adi Shankara. And the quote I'm going to read out is from a work which is widely attributed to him, and it's called Atmabodha. I quote, "The soul appears to be finite because of ignorance. When ignorance is destroyed, the self, which does not admit of any multiplicity, truly reveals itself by itself, like the sun when the clouds pass away." End of quote. For most of us who have heard and read many of Swami's discourses, this quote is quite self-explanatory and it's quite acceptable too. But the idea portrayed here by Shankara is the basic concept of Vedanta philosophy itself. Many schools of Vedanta debate about a number of things, like how creation came about, what exactly is liberation, how does matter and energy interact, and so on. But most of them agree that the Atma or the soul is divine, perfect, and contains in it all knowledge. The moment we accept this fact, the approach to gain spiritual wisdom becomes just the opposite of the process of gaining worldly knowledge. In secular education, we gather knowledge, we add value to our intelligence by acquiring information. We become cultured by learning culture. But the moment you say, "I am essentially perfect, but there is something which is blocking my perfection from expressing itself," the process does not become one of gaining or gathering, but one of discarding and unraveling. So the belief is, here within me is infinity, but something is covering it and making it appear finite. as I remove this obstruction, I reveal the infinity that lies within. In fact, I'll be using this very fundamental concept to answer one of the questions today. But for now, let me read that quote one more time for all of you. The soul appears to be finite because of ignorance. When ignorance is destroyed, the self, which does not admit of any multiplicity, truly reveals itself by itself, like the sun when the clouds pass away. Let's then head to the questions of the week, dear listeners. Today I'm going to answer only one listener, but there will be two questions nevertheless. The person asking the question wishes not to be named, but she has recorded the question in her own voice, so I'm very grateful for that. I will play out her whole question, the whole set of questions that she's asked us, but will answer only the first part for now. At the end of the answer, probably I will play the second part again, and we will answer that part. So let us first listen to the entire question sent to us by the listener in her own voice.
Om Sai Ram. Sai Ram Prem, thanks for being there as his master's voice. This indeed is Swami's grace. Books on Swami, discourses, lectures and satsang discourses are all very enlightening. But in practical life, many questions are popping up from time to time. In recent episodes, your matured and sensible answers to a few very sensitive questions have emboldened me to try my luck. So, here are two quotes and two questions. And I quote, "Sometimes excess of love can suffocate you," unquote. My question is, how can a sublime feeling like love suffocate? Can it be quantified? This is a wee bit lesser than enough, or this is just sufficient, or this is too much, it may suffocate me. Regarding the second question, the quote is, I quote, "Swami doesn't like unnecessary contacts." The question is, love all, serve all should be our motto, right? Now, if we lovingly serve people, we meet them, make contacts, find out how can we help them. Pray how to differentiate between the necessary and unnecessary contacts, where to draw the line and how. We definitely do not want anyone to suffer for our callousness. Thanks and Sai Ram.
Thank you for both those questions. To answer the first question, if I were to answer it in one line, yes, love cannot suffocate you. A sublime quality such as love cannot suffocate a person at all. If someone's love is suffocating us, it can only mean one of two things. It is not love, or we are misunderstanding their love. I think the problem arises because we have completely misunderstood the word love and also used the word very liberally to describe a plethora of relationships. It's right in a sense because love is the underlying principle, but it is wrong because true love can be quite different from the love we refer to in day-to-day usage. I think more than discussing about judging others' love towards us, I think it would be useful if we are to examine how to make our love perfect such that it does not suffocate another. I think you'll agree with me on this point. See, there are two reasons why I'm suggesting this approach. One is, obviously, it is better to focus on what we can change about ourselves rather than to judge others. The second reason is, if we perfect our love, I don't think we will see the love being shown to us by others as suffocating. A simple example, I don't think Swami would have ever found our love suffocating, however much imperfect our love might have been. On the other hand, even though Swami's love is perfect, we misunderstand it because of the imperfections in our love, right? And when we say perfect love, it is pretty much perfection itself. We become perfect in all senses when we perfect our love. I'll maybe explain that statement a bit later, but for now, we can say when we become perfect, our responses to others are bound to become perfect. And that, I feel, will address the issue, how do I know whose love is suffocating and whose is not? Because that question is all about how to respond to our interactions, right? So how do we love perfectly? Now, here comes a very important perspective, which I mentioned even in my introduction. And this is where we must begin. To love perfectly, we need not learn anything new, but we must rather unlearn or remove something from us. In other words, to love perfectly is our nature, but there is some aspect of human life that is either adulterating our love or stopping us from completely expressing that perfect love which is our very nature. There's a beautiful quote by Anthony de Mello which explains this very, very beautifully and succinctly. When the eye is unobstructed, sight happens. When the heart is unobstructed, love happens. He explains, we don't have to do anything we don't have to put any effort for the eye to see. If you remove what is obstructing your sight, your eyes just see, right? Similarly, when you remove that which obstructs this heart, you just love. So what does obstruct our heart? If we can identify that and deal with that, our love will become perfect and will not suffocate another person. In his discourses, Swami would very often address this. I think most of us have heard it. Swami would say, Prema Swarupa Lara. And the meaning of that is embodiments of love. It means we are nothing but love captured in a human body. And that is our hint, I feel. It is in being embodied that this love becomes a little adulterated. I'm not suggesting that we put an end to the body or adopt some unnatural way to distance ourselves from the body. The whole problem comes when we attach ourselves to this body, or putting it more precisely, identify ourselves with the body. What exactly happens when we do that? I think as part of other answers I've discussed this, the idea of I am the body arises in the mind and we call it ahankara, right? But this mind, which is in the body, is represented by the brain and its functions. You know, we generally tend to see the mind as bad and ahankara is evil in the spiritual path. I think this is a misconception most of us have. Let's try and take a little charitable view and examine what is the role of the mind, or more so of the conscious mind, in the human life. And for that, we have to see what functions the brain, which I said is a representation of the mind, plays in our life. When we study the brain and its functions, one fact becomes more and more clear. The brain does whatever it takes to protect the personality it is attached to, a process that is generally referred to as self-preservation. On one hand, the physical brain regulates all the functions of the body to ensure that life continues. And only as long as there is life, the self can attach itself to this mind-body complex, right? So the most basic function of the body, or of the brain or the mind, is to protect the body from harm and to help it to live. The fact that this is the fundamental function of the mind can be seen during what we call a fight or flight response when a person is in danger. Because during such a situation, the brain starts shutting down all other processes such as reproduction, appreciation of finer things in life like tastes, beautiful sights, and so on. And even the idea of right and wrong. The brain only tries to protect life at a moment of extreme emergency. So this shows us that mind's most fundamental role is preservation of life. When the life is not in danger, what does this mind do? It tries to protect everything that adds value to this personality. It tries to acquire all that makes this personality happy, satisfied, and peaceful. The mind will go after desires, fiercely protect self-respect, name and fame, and go after all such activities that can make you feel good. But as Swami would say, along with ahankara comes another quality, and that is mamakara, or the feeling of mine. My son, my daughter, my husband, my wife, my family, my company, my country, and so on, right? So effectively, what are we doing? We are increasing this idea of me and mine. From saying my body to my whatever, once that expansion happens, the mind, whose primary role is self-preservation, will now work to do what it believes is best for this new expansive idea of the self. And how does this mind go about protecting the interest of the self, the expanded self, as I just explained? Through the use of the intellect. The discrimination between good and bad, likes and dislikes, fears and desires. It tries to go after or avoid things and events based on this idea of discrimination. So before moving ahead, let me quickly recap whatever I've been saying so far. What is the purpose of this mind? It is to perform what is referred to as self-preservation. So what is important is the idea of the self, and that is called ahankara. And along with ahankara, or the feeling of I and me, comes mamakara, or mine, which in a sense expands this idea of self, and with it the idea of self-preservation. And this act of self-preservation is done through the use of the buddhi, or discrimination, choosing and discarding based on what it believes will lead to self-preservation. Okay, now what does all this have to do with love? I think that's the question most of you must be wondering. For a moment, we will forget the idea that by nature we are capable of loving perfectly. In day-to-day life, when and whom do we love? Swami would tell a beautiful chinakatha. You know, there were two neighbors. One had a daughter and one had a son. One day the girl fell very sick and was hospitalized and was even about to die. Then she recovers and comes back home. And Swami says the neighbors hear the news and maybe they feel a little bit of pity for the poor girl. Then when the boy and girl grow up, the elders get them both married. And after a few days of the marriage, the girl has a simple fever and now the boy is so pained and disturbed. Swami would say, when she was about to die, this boy did not feel bad for her. But now he is almost in tears when the same girl has a simple fever. Why is that? Because he loves her, right? But where has that love come from? It has come from the feeling that this is my wife. So this is not that pure love that we spoke of, but what we call conditional love. It depends on and varies with time, person, and relationship, right? That is why Swami would say this is attachment. Now let us say you have love for someone. I'm putting it this way for the sake of understanding, but I'll explain it later why this is not a comprehensive way of looking at it. That love that you have for another has both these components. One component is the pure unconditional love, which is our very nature, and the other component is this love conditioned by mamakara, or attachment. This mamakara can be anything from something specific like so-and-so is my child, my family, to something more broad like so-and-so is my caste or my countrymen, right? The more the love is out of ahankara and mamakara, the more suffocating this love will be when showered on another person. If ahankara, or the feeling of I am only this body and personality, is removed, with it will go all mamakara too, or the feeling of mind, and we will be freeing this nature within us to love. When the heart is unobstructed, love happens naturally and perfectly. That's why Swami would often say there is no difference between perfect wisdom or jnana and perfect love or prema. Since our nature is love, the moment we give up this idea, I am the body, and develop this idea that I am the soul, which is one and the same as in everyone, you will feel a surge of unconditional love towards all creation. And isn't that what we all saw in Swami? But I'd like to come back to the main question for a moment. How can love suffocate? Let me try to explain that with what we derived about the functions of the mind. When my love for someone comes from the feeling of temporary belonging, first of all, it is based on the idea of possessiveness. And when there is possessiveness, there is a feeling of exclusiveness. That person should give me first preference. I love so much, but that person does not love me as much. These sort of expectations arise, right? Because this whole process of love is an extension of what we refer to as self-preservation. So underlying this conditional love, there is always the self-interest that is lurking. Let me give another example. Let's say I give my nephew a piece of advice. I certainly have his welfare in my mind when I advise, and that comes from my love for him, right? But say he does not heed my advice. Somewhere I feel hurt that I told him and he did not follow. Now that feeling comes from the fact that my ego was hurt, isn't it? Also coupled with this possessiveness is our idea of what is right and wrong, because of which we try to impose our idea of right and wrong on the other person. This is also a major reason why some people's love suffocates us, because we too have our own thinking, right? That also explains how it is easy to accept Swami's love, because we know whatever Swami does is good for me, and we know that Swami always knows best. So when we are sure of these two things, we will experience Swami's perfect love, and that love will be not suffocating but liberating. Final few points, how do we have that perfect love, or how do we develop that perfect love? I'd initially told that our love has both components, but let me explain that with a different imagery for now. Actually, we don't have two types of love, but only one love, which is pure and divine. We restrict its flow through our ego and attachment. So much so, we feel that we can express love only through attachment. But if we can remove this idea that I am the body, then our love will automatically become perfect. Initially, I mentioned that we cannot adopt unnatural methods to distance ourselves from our body, right? Swami says in a discourse, what is so great about removing this body identification, or what we call dehabhimanam? If you drink a little alcohol, it goes. But can we have perfect love being drunk? Swami explains, that is not the way this has to be achieved. Even as we remove dehabhimanam, we must cultivate atmabhimanam, or identification with the atma. The other unnatural method would be to remove this concept of self-preservation mechanism. Just because I said the mind is involved in self-preservation, which is actually a form of selfishness, let me remove that nature alone. That will only result in suicidal tendencies. That is not spiritual progress. So the key is, even as we give up this idea that I am the body through self-inquiry, we must expand this idea of the self so much so we recognize ourselves as one with the entire creation. And that can happen through qualities such as kindness and empathy. That way the mind will continue to do its function of self-preservation, but only now the self is becoming the universal self. So let me try to summarize what I've said. I think I've said so much that the answer to the question itself may be lost in that. The question was, how can a sublime feeling like love suffocate another? Love by itself cannot suffocate, but love that is impure or imperfect is what suffocates the one who is the object of such love. What makes love imperfect? When it is mixed with this feeling of I and mine, or ahankara and mamakara. So when the person loving us is loving us because he or she feels we belong to them, then the love will become suffocating. And that love suffocates because the feeling of I and mine is the basis of the fundamental function of the mind, which is called self-preservation. And it is this love that becomes suffocating when it becomes very strong. Because more of this love means more of possessiveness, and the person showing such love can be easily hurt when the love is not responded to, because this love is more self-serving. Also, the mind performs this task of self-preservation through the faculty of discrimination. So when love is born of ego and possessiveness, one tends to impose one's idea of good and bad on the other person. But the fact is, all of us by nature are capable of loving perfectly. So when in the spiritual path, as we subdue our ego and possessiveness, our ability to love truly starts getting liberated. In a sense, we can say our love to a person or the love we receive from someone is a mix of true or unconditional love and this conditioned or attachment-based love. And the last point, more than wondering whether the love which we receive is suffocating or not, pure or not, if we concentrate on our ability to love, the way we love at others' love, the way we look at others' love will change. Simple proof, if our love is imperfect, even Swami's love, which is perfect, seems to have some flaws. But as Swami once was telling a student, when I say I have love for all of you, I really mean it. That is why when anyone comes and tells me, Swami, I love you, I believe you completely. Because Swami's love was perfect, I don't think he ever felt suffocated because of our love. Rather, we could perfect our love through this process of loving Swami. So as we love Swami and those around us, if we can slowly give up our identification with the body, its relations and possessions, and identify with all beings around, we will not learn to love, we will literally unleash the love which remains bound within us. If anything I said was not clear, feel free to write to me again. So that was the answer I wanted to give for the question, the first part of the question from that listener. Let's now head to the second question posed by that same person. As I said, I will play only that part once more before answering the question. So this is the second half of the question which we will be answering now.
Regarding the second question, the quote is, I quote, Swami doesn't like unnecessary contacts. The question is, love all, serve all should be our motto, right? Now, if we lovingly serve people, we meet them, make contacts, find out how can we help them. Pray how to differentiate between the necessary and unnecessary contacts. Where to draw the line and how. We definitely do not want anyone to suffer for our callousness. Thanks and Sai Ram.
Swami doesn't like unnecessary contacts. This is a point which we would hear very, very often when we were students. Have less contacts. And this is also an instruction that Swami would give people coming to the ashram or settling down in the ashram or in Puttaparthi. So why does Swami say we must have less contacts? Maybe if we first look at that, the reason why Swami says that, we will be able to decide based on the reasons how to differentiate between necessary and unnecessary contacts. And more importantly, as the questioner has asked, to be able to strike a balance between these two instructions of Swami. Have less contacts on one hand and love all, serve all on the other hand. I will start with why Swami would say that to students. Because I have been a student and I know how we practiced it in the hostel and how it benefited us. There were three instructions that Swami would keep reminding us about when we were students. And they are talk less, study more, and have less contacts. And I still recall whenever Swami would be upset with all of our students, when he would stop talking to us, we would have these seniors who would put up notices and posters on the corridors of the hostel with these three statements of Swami. And it would be a strong reminder, the whole hostel will become quieter, and eventually Swami would respond by forgiving us and would start talking to us again. Well, we can't say that it was because of that, because of what we did that we earned Swami's grace, but that would be a very preposterous suggestion to make. But Swami would acknowledge these acts of us so that we carry this message with us that Swami likes us to follow such principles. So that way it has really got into our thinking that Swami wants us to have less contacts. So much so that though we would study for 3 to 5 years together in the hostel, sometimes we would not even know from which state the other person is from. Well, not always, but in some cases at least. But that does not mean we were not friends or we were not living like brothers. So why does Swami want his students to follow this instruction? And this reason is applicable to all people who wish to pursue a spiritual path. It is primarily to reduce excessive talk. The primary step in spiritual sadhana is to control the senses, right? Swami would explain why excessive talk has to be reduced through this analogy which is given in the Kathopanishad. The senses are compared to a horse, and the buddhi or intellect is supposed to be the charioteer that controls the horses that are attached to the chariot of the body. Swami would say, now if you wish to bridle a horse, you put the bridle in the mouth of the horse, right? Such a powerful and swift animal can be completely controlled through this small bridle in the mouth. That is because the mouth is the most vulnerable part of the horse. Similarly, Swami would say, all the senses can be brought under control by controlling this one faculty of speech. And like the horse, our mouth or tongue is our most vulnerable faculty. Of course, Swami speaks of the importance of controlling both speech and taste in this context. So one of the main ideas behind having less contacts is to speak less. Swami would say a beautiful couplet in Telugu. It would go thus, Mita Bhasha Atihai, Ati Bhasha Matihani. Mita Bhasha Atihai, Ati Bhasha Matihani. Mita Bhasha means limited talk, not complete silence necessarily, but limited talk. Atihai means immense peace or joy. Ati Bhasha means excessive talk, and Matihani, where Mati means mind and Matihani means harmful to the mind. So Swami says, less talk gives more peace and excessive talk damages the mind. Hence, it is important to understand that the basic idea of less contacts is to talk less. So it is quite counterproductive or meaningless if we have few contacts but don't reduce excessive talk, right? Right, when it comes to the people in the ashram, whether they permanently stay here or those who come to visit, why is this instruction of Swami very important? When we choose to come to the ashram, we are making a conscious choice to be here instead of elsewhere, right? It's a resolute step towards a spiritual endeavor. And the idea is to focus on God, focus on one's sadhana, isn't it? So it is very important to keep the purpose of our choice always in mind. What is the point if I live in Puttaparthi, but continue to socialize, have friends, endlessly indulge in talk and banter, in a sense, live my city life here in Puttaparthi? Just by choosing to stay or come here, I will not reach my purpose. I should make a conscious effort to pursue my purpose, and coming to an ashram is only an aid to that purpose. And this is not necessarily only for people who live here. Wherever you may live, if you have made a conscious choice to lead a spiritual life, we must be ready to make some changes to our basic living. We must ensure that our life as a whole is aligned to the choice we have made. Swami does not want us to run away to the forest. In fact, Swami repeatedly tells us, whether to our students or to devotees, that he doesn't want sannyasis or recluses. He wants people who will live and work in the society, who will serve and transform their surroundings. But there must be a certain change in our life, and one of that is limited talk and being very conscious about what we speak. The other day, one of my seniors working in the ashram was sharing with me how Swami was very particular about this point, that we should be very conscious of what we speak and take complete responsibility for what we say. The moment you tell something to Swami, apparently Swami will ask, Niketla Telsu, how do you know? Which means you can't come and share some hearsay or some rumor. Swami would say that, Swami would discourage that. This quality of collecting and passing on information, which is either not related to us or we have not had the opportunity to validate it. So that brings me to the next reason why Swami would say have less contacts. I remember in 2009, Swami had spoken a couple of times in discourses about the usage of cell phones. So this same instruction of have less contacts, Swami had told in the context of using cell phones. Swami said, try your best not to use them. If you have one and you have to use it, be careful of to whom you give your number and don't keep collecting all kinds of contacts. And the reason Swami gave when he was speaking about this is, we start with an essential conversation, but then move on to being curious about the other person, and then it ends up in talking about others, or what we call gossip. And as Swami would say, the tongue is prone to four mistakes: excessive talk, speaking lies, and the next two are talking ill of others and carrying tales. It is avoid these mistakes, Swami says, keep limited contacts. And this is not just for people in the ashram or students. Swami gives this as a very important instruction to samitis and sai centers too. When you come for bhajans, resist the temptation to convert the prayer gathering into a social gathering. In fact, Swami would say it is better not to have an elaborate prasadam session after bhajans, because then people will hang around and start chatting and socializing, beating the very purpose of coming for bhajans. Well, these instructions for bhajan sessions are not something I'm making up right now. These are clearly Swami's instructions. This having contacts leading to excessive and unnecessary talks starts with curiosity. We wanting to know about others' lives. And this is something that we need to control in the spiritual path. Swami would say, instead of constantly asking others, who are you? You must spend time in asking, who am I? Our curiosity must be turned to such exploration. Why should we avoid curiosity about others and events and news in the spiritual path? This is because of one important quality of the mind, which is its limitation as well as its advantage. And at any given moment, the mind can think of only one thought. The very next moment it can think of something else, but at that one moment it can entertain only one thought. And because of this quality, the more it is preoccupied with matters of the world, matters relating to others and their lives, that much mind space or mind time we are giving to such unnecessary things. So the ultimate goal of a sadhaka is to give less mind space to things relating to the world and more mind space to God and spiritual thoughts. There is a strong correlation between the senses and the thoughts in the mind. The senses, as Swami would say, are the window to the mind. Especially speech and hearing have to be taken care of if the mind has to be silenced or made to think of higher things. And this can be controlled if we have less contacts. And to have less contacts, we must try and curb our curiosity. Of course, another reason why we tend to gather more contacts is to express this desire to speak about ourselves and our achievements. And this is harmful in multiple levels. This leads to the ego and the desire for people to respect us for what we are. And some people even end up resorting to falsehood because they have created an image for themselves among their contacts and wish to maintain it at all times. Imagine, all of this can be avoided if we follow this discipline of having less contacts. Now, coming to the aspect of how to have less contacts when we say we must love all and serve all. Yes, as long as our making contacts is not driven by the desire to satisfy our curiosity, speak about ourselves, speak about others, or indulge in excessive talk, and is purely driven by a desire to help, I think there shouldn't be any problem. Once we identify why Swami asks us to avoid having too many contacts, we can keep reviewing ourselves and our motives to make sure we are not indulging in those flaws. But even for being helpful, we just have to be a little observant. When we feel someone is not normal, someone is looking low or troubled, it then becomes our duty to try and help that person out. And sometimes the greatest seva we can do for a person is to be a good listener when they wish to share their problems. But to be able to play even this role, to do this service, that person should have the confidence that what is shared with you will stay with you, right? And you will not go around talking about it. That will be possible only if you are a person who practices this virtue of having less contacts. In fact, in this context, I can talk about some of the teachers in the Swami's college. I have seen them striking this balance beautifully. See, they had to play the role of mentors and people who are there to listen to and solve problems of students. But at the same time, they would also not be too curious about our personal or family matters. So more than talking to us, they would be very silently observing us. And when they feel there is something wrong, they would speak to us in private and would encourage us to share our problems. And they would do it so silently that no one else would know about it. And we as students would also have the confidence that we can trust them with our problems. For instance, I remember something that happened to one of my seniors. There was some problem and this boy's parents were not able to send the mess fees for almost a semester. For the listeners who may not be aware, Swami's colleges are completely free, but we would pay a very nominal mess charge for our food and boarding. So this boy's parents could not send him the money that particular semester. Somehow, one of the teachers got to know about this. He happened to see the list of, I think, those yet to pay, or he heard the person in the office speak to that boy. So this teacher sent word for this boy and asked him if he had any problem in paying the fees and also offered to pay on his behalf. And to make that boy feel comfortable, he narrated how when he was a student, once his father called up and said that the shop that the father was running was completely gutted in a fire accident and he would not be able to send him money for the next few months. Physically, Swami was not informed about this. But imagine, Swami observed this boy and his brother and noticed that he was living life a little frugally than usual. See, this is so important to note. Swami knows everything. Swami is omniscient. But he does this drama so that we learn how we must be observant of those around. After observing this boy and his brother, Swami called the warden and then called the boy himself and told him that henceforth Swami will pay all the fees and for the needs of him and his brother after Swami came to know about what had happened. And that teacher narrated this incident to that boy that day and said, "See, Swami has done so much for me, but I cannot go and repay him the money that he gave me. The only way I can repay him is if I help those around me." I narrated this incident to highlight how Swami wants us to serve. This teacher did not know anything about this boy or his family, but he was sensitive enough to sense when someone around him needed help, called him in private and gave him confidence and also made him feel comfortable by narrating how he has also been in that same situation. And then narrates an incident not to show how great he is or how fortunate he is to win Swami's grace, but just because the teacher felt that moment was appropriate to narrate that incident and then help that boy. So if our intention is to help, maybe these are things we have to keep in mind. What is the motive behind me making contacts? Am I looking to gain some mileage out of it? Am I using the fact that I know so-and-so or I know so many people to gain some favor or even to gain popularity? Putting it in one sentence, we don't need to make friends with everyone, but we can be friendly with everyone at all times. Swami would say, we all must cultivate four qualities: karuna, mudita, upeksha and maitri. Karuna is having compassion when you see someone in pain and going to help them. Mudita, if someone is doing well in life, feel happy for them genuinely. If someone is evil and you cannot transform them, keep away from them but without hatred, and that is upeksha, a kind of indifference. And finally, maitri, have a friendly disposition towards all, considering everyone as equal to you. So love all and serve all is an attitude we must cultivate, but it is not necessary to make endless contacts and friends to be able to love all. So let me quickly summarize what I've said so far. Yes, Swami always would tell us as students and devotees that we must have less contacts. Why does Swami say so? The ultimate motive is to give as less mind space as possible to unnecessary things when we take to the spiritual path. Mind is connected to the senses, so if we want less noise in the mind, we must reduce talking more and taking in unnecessary information through our ears. This can be achieved if we have lesser contacts. When we were students, Swami would say, keep every contact within the limit of purpose. If you go to see your friend asking for a book, do only that work and come back. Don't indulge in endless banter having gone there for a book. So keep contacts to the extent as it is necessary. When we have lesser contacts, we can avoid the three sins the tongue is likely to indulge in, or rather four sins: excessive talk, carrying tales, speaking ill of others, and speaking lies. So when we have contacts and friends, we can at least ensure that we avoid all of these things, which are the reason why Swami says have less contacts. Do we need to keep making friends and acquaintances to follow the instruction, love all and serve all? Not at all. What is needed for that is sensitivity and an attitude of friendliness. In fact, if we follow the instruction of have least contacts possible, we will be in a better position to love all and serve all. Lastly, if we are drawing any kind of mileage because of our contacts, I know so and so, or try to impress others, or seek friendship to talk about ourselves and cut our contacts, it is not enough. Sorry. So people can respect us, we must control ourselves and reduce our contacts. It is not enough if we choose to stay in the ashram or choose to become spiritual or start going to samitis and centers. One choice will not change our lives. Only when we consciously make an effort to align our life and everyday activities to the choice we have made, our life changes. So thank you for that question. It gave us a lot of opportunity to dwell on an important aspect of practicing Swami's message. If you have anything more to ask on the topic or anything else, you can as always write to me at prem@radiosai.org. That is a wrap on this week's show, dear listeners. Thank you for joining me. Do you have a question on Swami's message on how we can practically implement it in our day-to-day life, or a problem for which you are wondering what would Swami want me to do? Then Radio Sai Answering Booth is a program just for you. Send me your questions by mail. My mail ID is prem@radiosai.org. That's prem@radiosai.org. That's my personal mail ID, so confidentiality is guaranteed from my end. Like the listener today, if you can send me a recording of your answer, I would be really, really appreciate that. I'll take your leave then. Do join me again next Thursday at 11 a.m. on Asia Stream for the Radio Sai Answering Booth. I most humbly offer this little effort of mine at Swami's Lotus Feet.